shrugged again.
Did anyway, though.
He and Hesina began digging through the maps, Relaine chatting with them as they did. He seemed to like these humans, and looked more comfortable around them than he was with her. Beyond that, the way he used human mannerisms to exaggerate his emotions, the way the rhythms were a subtle accent to his words rather than the driving power behind them, it all seemed a little pathetic. Lirin returned to his work, tending the unconscious. Venli strolled over to him, attuning curiosity.
You don't like what they're doing, Venli said, nodding toward the other two.
I'm undecided, Lirin said. My gut says that stealing a few maps won't hurt the occupation. But perhaps if we turned the maps in and claimed we found them in a forgotten room, there's a good chance it would earn us favor with the Fused. Perhaps it would prove Hesina and I aren't malcontents, so we could come out of hiding.
It isn't the hiding that protects you, Venli said. It is Lady Leshwi's favor. Without it, the pursuer would kill you, no matter what you did to prove yourself. He'd kill other Fused if he thought it would let him fulfill his tradition, and the others would applaud him.
Lirin grunted, a human version of derision, she thought, as he knelt beside a Radiant and lifted her eyelids to check her eyes.
Nice to know your government has its idiocies too.
You really don't want to resist, do you? Venli said to awe. You truly want to live with the occupation.
I resist by controlling my situation, Lirin said, and by working with those in power rather than giving them reason to hurt me and mine. It's a lesson I learned very painfully. Fetch me some water.
Venli was halfway to the water station before she realized she'd done what he said, despite telling him several times that he needed to show her more respect. What a strange man. His attitude was so commanding and in charge, but he used it to reinforce his own subservience. Timber thrummed as Venli returned to him with the water. She needed to practice her powers some more, particularly if she might be required to tunnel them down through many feet of rock to reach an exit. She took the tunnel map and gave it to Gile, one of her loyalists. Gile folded it and placed it into her pocket as a knock sounded at the door. Venli glanced toward Relaine and Hesina, but they'd apparently heard, for they covered up the crate of maps. It still looked suspicious to Venli, but she went to the door anyway. Fused wouldn't knock. Accordingly, she opened the door and let in a group of humans who bore water jugs on poles across their shoulders. Six workers, the same ones as always. That was good. For although Venli had permission from Raboniel to bring a human surgeon in to care for the fallen Radiants, she had lied in saying she'd gone to the clinic to recruit him. Eventually, Lirin and Hesina would be recognized, but best to limit their exposure to as few people as possible. The water carriers delivered their burdens to the room's large troughs, then helped with the daily watering of the patients. It demanded near constant work to give broth and drink to so many unconscious people. Venli checked the time by the rhythm of peace. She needed to visit Raboniel for translation duty soon. There were books in Thalen that the Lady of Wishes wanted read to her.
She doesn't care about anything other than her research, Venli thought. What could be so important?
You there, Lirin said. What is that on your head?
Venli turned to find the surgeon confronting one of the water bearers. Lirin pushed back the hair on the man's head and pointed. She hummed to irritation. The surgeon was generally calm, but once in a while something set him off. She strode over to settle the situation, to find that the water bearer, a short man with far too much hair on his body, had painted his forehead with some kind of ink.
What is that? Venli asked.
Nothing, brightness, the man said, pulling out of Lirin's grip. Just a little reminder.
He moved on, but one of the other water carriers, a female this time, had a similar marking on her forehead.
"It's a Shash glyph," Liren said.
As soon as Venli knew it was writing, her powers interpreted it.
"Dangerous? Why do they think they're dangerous?"
"They don't,"
Liren said, wearing his upset emotions on his face.
"They're fools."
He turned to go, but Venli caught him by the arm and hummed to Craving, which of course he couldn't understand. So she asked, "What does it mean?"
"It's the brand on the forehead of Kaladin Stormblessed."
"Ah. He gives them hope."
"That hope is going to get them killed," Liren said, lowering his voice. "This isn't the way to fight. Not with how brutal the Regals in the tower have started acting. My son may have gotten himself killed resisting them. Harald said it isn't true, but his example is going to cause trouble. Some of these might get the terrible idea of following in his steps, and that will inevitably provoke a massacre."
"Maybe," Venli said, letting him go. Timber pulsed to an unfamiliar rhythm that echoed in her mind. What was it? She could swear she'd never heard it before. "Or maybe they simply need something to keep them going, Surgeon. A symbol they can trust when they can't trust their own hearts." The surgeon shook his head and turned away from the water carriers, instead focusing on his patients. Shallan's sketchbook, Peak Spren. Like many other Spren in Shadesmar, Peak Spren wear human clothing. Peak Spren fashion, and to some degree their features, remind me of the Unkalaki. The cracks in their skin don't appear to affect them in any way. Some of these cracks almost seem to form glyphs or symbols. There is as much variety in color and texture to their stone forms as could be imagined by any geologist. They can be as smooth as polished marble or as rough as porous basalt. In the physical realm, Peak Spren can disappear into stone to stay hidden. To reappear, they break out of other nearby stone, even if it's as small as a pebble.
75. The Middle Step.
There was a time when others would approach me for help with a problem. A time when I was decisive, capable, even authoritative.
It was a crystalline day in Shadesmar as Edolin, guarded as always by two Honor Spren soldiers, climbed to the top of the walls of Lasting Integrity. During his weeks incarcerated in the fortress, he'd discovered that there were weather patterns in Shadesmar. They just weren't the same type as in the physical realm. When he reached the top of the wall, he could see a faint shimmer in the air. It was only visible if you could look a long distance. A kind of violet-pink haze. Crystalline, they called it. On days like these, plants in Shadesmar grew quickly enough to see the change with your eyes. Other types of weather involved Spren feeling invigorated or dreary, or certain types of smaller Spren getting more agitated. It was never about temperature or precipitation. From the top of the wall, he could really get a sense of the fortress's size. Lasting Integrity was enormous, several hundred feet tall. It was also hollow and had no roof. Rectangular and resting on the small side, all four of its walls were perfectly sheer, without windows. No human city would ever have been built this way. Even your Ethiru needed fields at its base and windows to keep the people from going mad. But Lasting Integrity didn't follow normal laws of nature. You could walk on the interior walls. Indeed, to reach the top, Adolin had strolled vertically up the inside of the fortress wall. His body thought he had been walking on the ground. However, at the end of the path, he'd reached the battlements. Getting onto them had required stepping off what seemed to be the edge of the ground. As he'd done so, gravity had caught his foot, then propelled him over, so he was now standing at the very top of the fortress. He felt vertigo as he glanced down along a wall he'd recently treated as the ground. In fact, he could see all the way to the floor, hundreds of feet below. Thinking about it gave him a headache. So he looked outward across the landscape, and the view. The view was spectacular. Lasting Integrity overlooked a sea of churning beads lit by the cold sun, so they shimmered and sparkled, an entire ocean of captured stars. Huge swells washed through the bay and broke into crashing falls of tumbling beads. It was mesmerizing, made all the more interesting by the lights that congregated and moved in the near distance. Tukar and the people who lived there reflected in the cognitive realm. The other direction had its own less dramatic charms. Rocky obsidian shores gave way to growing forests of glass, lifespren bobbing among the trees. Lifespren were larger here, though still small enough that he wouldn't have been able to see them save for the bright green glow they gave off. These lights blinked off and on, a behavior that seemed unique to this region of Shadesmar. Watching, Adolin could swear there was a coordination to their glows. They'd blink in rippling waves, synchronized, as if to a beat. He took it in for a moment. The view wasn't why he'd come, however. Not fully. Once he'd spent time drinking in the beauty, he scanned the nearby coast. Their camp was still there, tucked away a short walk into the highlands, nearer the trees. Godeki, Felt, and Molly waited for the results of his trial. With some persuasion, the honor spren had allowed Godeki to come in, given him a little stormlight, and then let him heal Adolin's wound. The honor spren had expelled Godeki soon after, but permitted Adolin to communicate with his team via letters. They'd traded, with his permission, a few of his swords to a passing caravan of reachers for more food and water. Non-manifested weapons were worth a lot in Shadesmar. The Stump, Zhu, and the rest of Adolin's soldiers had left to bring word to his father. Though Adolin had initially anticipated a quick and dramatic end to his incarceration, the honor spren hadn't wanted an immediate trial. He should have realized the punctilious spren would want time to prepare. Though aspects of the delay were frustrating, the wait favored him. The longer he spent among the honor spren, the more chance he had to persuade them. Theoretically. So far, the spren of this fortress seemed about as easy to persuade as rocks. One other oddity was visible from this high perch. Gathering on the coast nearby was an unusual group of spren. It had begun about 2 weeks ago as a few scattered individuals, but those numbers grew each day. At this point, there had to be 200 of them. They stood on the coast all hours of the day, motionless, speechless. Dead eyes.
"Storms," said Bayou. "There are so many."
Bayou was Adolin's primary jailer for excursions like this. He was a shorter honor spren and wore a full beard, squared like that of an ardent. Unlike many others, Vayu preferred to go about bare-chested, wearing only an old-style skirt, a little like an Alethi Takama. With his winged spear, he seemed like a depiction of a herald from some ancient painting. "What happened to the ones you let in?" Adolin asked.
"We put them with the others," Vayu explained. "Everything about them seems normal, for dead eyes. Though we don't have space left for more. We never expected..."
He shook his head. There were no lights of souls near those dead eyes. This wasn't a gathering of shard-bearers in the physical realm. The dead eyes were moving of their own accord, coming up from the depths to stand out here. Silent. Watching. The fortress had quarters for dead eyes. Though Adolin had little love for these honor spren and their stubbornness, he had to admit there was honor in the way they treated fallen spren. The honor spren had dedicated themselves to finding and caring for as many as they could. Though they'd taken Maya and put her in with the others, they let Adolin visit her each morning to do their exercises together. While they wouldn't let her wander free, she was treated quite well. But what would they do with so many? The Honor Spren had taken in the first group, but as more and more Deadeyes arrived, the fortress had reluctantly shut its gates to them.
"It doesn't make any sense," Vayu said. "They should all be wandering the oceans, not congregating here. What provoked this behavior?"
"Has anyone tried asking them?" Adolin asked.
"Deadeyes can't talk."
Adolin leaned forward. Around his hands on the railing, pink crystal fuzz began to grow, the Shadesmar version of moss spreading because of the crystalline day. The distance was too great for him to distinguish one scratched-out face from another. However, he did notice when one vanished into mist. Those spren were shard blades, hundreds of them, more than he'd known existed. When their owners summoned them, their bodies evaporated from Shadesmar. Why were they here? Deadeyes usually tried to keep close to their owners, wandering through the ocean of beads.
"There is a connection happening," Vayu said. "Deadeyes cannot think, but they are still spren, bound to the spirit web of Roshar herself. They can feel what is happening in this keep, that justice will finally be administered."
"If you can call it justice," Adolin said, "to punish a man for what his ancestors did."
"You are the one who suggested this course, human," Vayu said. "You took their sins upon you. This trial cannot possibly make remediation for the thousands murdered, but the Deadeyes sense what is happening here."
Adolin glanced at his other guard, a veteran. She wore a breastplate and a steel cap, both formed from her substance, of course, above close-cropped hair. As usual, she stared forward, her lips closed. She rarely had anything to add.
"It is time for today's legal training," Bayou said. "You have very little time until the High Judge returns and your trial begins. You had best spend it studying instead of staring at the Deadeyes. Let's go."
Vale was really starting to hate this fortress. Lasting Integrity was built like a storming monolith, a stupid brick of a building with no windows. It was impossible to feel anything other than trapped while inside these walls. But that wasn't the worst of it. The worst was how Honor Spren had no respect whatsoever for the laws of nature. Vale opened the door from the small building she shared with Adolin, looking out at what seemed to be an ordinary street. A walkway of worked stone led from her front door and passed by several other small buildings before dead-ending at a wall. However, as soon as she stepped out, her brain started to panic. Another flat surface of stone hung in the air above her instead of the sky. It was clustered with its own buildings, and people, mostly Honor Spren, walked along its pathways. To her left and right were two other surfaces, much the same. The actual sky was behind her. She was walking on the inside surface of one of the walls of the fortress. It squeezed her mind, making her tremble. "Shallan," Vale thought, "you should be leading. You'd like the way this place looks." Shallan did not respond. She huddled deep within, refusing to emerge. Ever since they'd discovered that Pattern had been lying to them, probably for years, she had become increasingly reclusive. Vale was able to coax her out now and then, but lately something dangerous had come with her, something they were calling formless. Vale wasn't certain it was a new persona. If it wasn't, would that be even worse? Vale let Radiant take over. Radiant wasn't so bothered by the strange geometry, and she took off down the path without feeling vertigo, though even she had trouble sometimes. The worst parts were the strange halfway zones at the corners, where each plane met, where you had to step from one wall to another. The Honor Spren did it easily, but Radiant's stomach did somersaults every time she had to. "Shallan," Radiant thought, "you should sketch this place. We should carry drawings with us when we leave.
Nothing.
Honor Spren liked to keep the hour exactly, so the bells told Radiant she was on time as she turned up the side of the wall toward the sky, passing various groups of Spren going about their business. This wall of the fortress, the southern plain, was the most beautified, with gardens of crystalline plants of 100 different varieties. Fountains somehow flowed here, the only free water Radiant had seen in Shadesmar. She passed one fountain that surged and fell in powerful spouts. If a spray got beyond about 15 feet high, the water would suddenly break off the top and stream down toward the actual ground rather than back toward the wall plain. Storms. This place didn't make any kind of sense. Radiant turned away from the fountain and tried to focus on the people she was passing. She hadn't expected to find anyone other than Honor Spren in here, considering how strict the fortress was, but apparently its xenophobic policy had only been instituted a year ago. Any other people then living inside the fortress were allowed to stay, though they'd be forbidden re-entry if they left. That meant ambassadorial delegations from the other Spren nations, as well as some tradespeople and random wanderers, had been grandfathered into the Honor Spren lockdown. Most importantly, 17 humans lived here. Without direction from Shallan, and with the Honor Spren taking their time preparing their trial, Radiant and Vale had reached a compromise. They'd find Rastaris, the person Moraes had sent them to locate. They wouldn't take any actions against him unless they could get Shallan to decide, but Radiant was perfectly willing to locate him. This man, the phantom leader of the Sons of Honor, was a key part of this entire puzzle, and she was intensely curious why Moraes wanted him so badly. Rastaris was, according to Moraes, a human male. Radiant carried a description of the man in her pocket, though none of the Honor Spren Vale had asked knew the name. And unfortunately, the description was rather vague. A shorter human with thinning hair. Moraes said Rastaris was a secretive type and would likely be using an alias and perhaps a disguise. He was supposedly paranoid, which made perfect sense to Radiant. Rastaris led a group of people who had worked to restore the Singers and the Fused. The coming of the Everstorm had led to the fall of multiple kingdoms, the deaths of thousands, and the enslavement of millions. The Sons of Honor were deplorable for seeking these things. True, it wasn't clear their efforts had in fact influenced the return, but she could understand why they wanted to hide. Upon first entering the fortress, she'd asked to be introduced to the other humans residing in the place. In response, the Honor Spren had given her the full list of all humans living here. With limited locations to search, she'd assumed her task would be easy. Indeed, it had started out that way. She'd started with the largest group of people, a caravan of traders from a kingdom called Nalthus, a place out in the darkness, beyond the edges of the map. Vale had chatted with them at length, discovering that Azure, who had moved on from the fortress by now, was from the same land. Radiant had trouble conceptualizing what it meant for there to be kingdoms out away from the continent. Did Azure's people live on islands? In the ocean? No, Vale thought. We're avoiding the truth, Radiant. It means something else, like Moraes told us. Those people came from another land, another world. Radiant's mind reeled at the thought. She took a deep breath, slowing near a group of trees, real ones from the physical realm, kept alive with stormlight instead of sunlight, that were the centerpieces of this park. The tops were so high that when leaves fell off, they drifted down toward the real ground, though in the middle of the fortress. Shallan, Radiant thought, you could come and talk to people from other worlds. This is too big for Vale and me. Shallan stirred, but as she did, that darkness moved with her.
She quickly retreated.
Let's focus on today's mission, Radiant, Vale said.
Radiant agreed and forced Vale to emerge. She could handle the strange geography. She had to. She put her head down and continued. None of the travelers from Nalthus looked like Rastaris, or seemed likely to be him in disguise. The next handful on her list had been Horneaters. Apparently there was a clan of them who lived in Shadesmar. She doubted any were Rastaris, but she'd interviewed each of them just in case. That done, Vale had been left with 5 people. 4 turned out to be wanderers. None had been open about their pasts, but over the weeks she'd met with them one by one. After conversing with each, she had reported on them to Moraes. He had eliminated each of those as possibilities. Now, only a single name remained on her list. This person was the most reclusive of them all, but was male, and the descriptions of him from the Honor Spren indicated that he was probably her quarry. Today she would finally catch a glimpse of him. With the subject confirmed, she could call Moraes, find out what message she was supposed to deliver to Rastaris, then be done with this mission. The target called himself 16. He supposedly came out of his home once every 16 days exactly. The regularity of it amused the Honor Spren, who suffered the odd fellow because of the novelty. No one knew how he survived without food, and no one reported a terrible stench or anything like that from him, though he didn't ever seem to bathe or empty a chamber pot. Indeed, the more she'd learned about him, the more Vale was certain this mysterious man was her target. His home was a small box built near the statue garden. Vale had made a habit of visiting this garden, where she tried to coax Shallan out by drawing. It worked occasionally, though Shallan usually retreated after a half hour or so of sketching. Today, Vale curled up on a bench with a sketch pad, coat enveloping her, hat shading her eyes. Today was the day that 16 would emerge, assuming he followed his pattern. All she had to do was wait and not act suspicious. Shallan, Vale said, opening the sketchbook. See? It's time to draw. Shallan started to emerge. Unfortunately, a faint humming sound made her panic, and Vale was thrust back into control. She sighed, glancing to the side, to where Pattern walked among the statues, which she'd been told were of Honor Spren, killed in the recreants. Tall men and women with heroic builds and clothing that, though made of stone, seemed to ripple in the wind. How odd that they'd made these. After all, the real individuals were still around, though dead-eyed. Pattern bobbed over to her. He was easy to tell from other cryptics. He had an excitable spring to his step, while others slunk or crept, more furtive.
I thought you were watching the Nalthians today, Vale said. I was, he said, plopping down on the bench beside her. But, Vale, I do not think any of them are Rastaris. They do not look like him at all. They do not even look like people from Roshar. Why do you think Azure appeared so much like an Alethi when these have the wrong features?
Don't know, Vale said, pretending to sketch. But this Rastaris could be using something like light weaving. I need you to watch them carefully.
I am sorry, Pattern said,
his pattern slowing like a wilting plant.
I miss being with you.
You're worried you'll miss something important, traitor, Shallan thought, and want an excuse to keep spying on me. Vale sighed again. She reached over and put her hand on Pattern's. He hummed softly. We need to confront him, Radiant thought. We need to find out exactly why he is lying.
Vale wasn't so certain. It was all growing so messy. Pattern, Shallan's past, the mission they were on. She needed Shallan to remember. That would solve so much. Wait, Radiant thought. Vale, what do you know? What do you remember that I do not?
Vale, Pattern asked. Can I talk to Shallan?
I can't force her to emerge, Pattern, Vale said. Stormwinds. She suddenly felt so tired. We can try later, if you want. For now, 16 is going to come out of that house in a few minutes. I need to be ready to intercept him in a way that reveals his face, but doesn't make him suspicious of me. Pattern hummed.
Do you remember, he said softly, when we first met on the boat with Yasna? You jumped in the water. She was so shocked.
Nothing shocks Yasna.
That did. I barely remember. I was so new to your realm.
That wasn't the first time we met, though, Radiant said, sitting up straighter. Shallan had spoken oaths before, after all. She had a shard blade.
Yes.
If he had been human, his posture would have been described as unnaturally still. Hands clasped, seated primly. His pattern moved, expanding, contracting, rotating upon itself, like an explosion.
I think, he finally said, we have been doing this wrong, Radiant. I once tried to help Shallan remember, and that was painful for her. Too painful. So I started to think it was good for her not to remember. And the lies were delicious. Nothing is better than a lie with so much truth.
The holes in her past, Radiant said. Shallan doesn't want to remember them.
She can't. At least not yet.
When Shallan summoned you as a blade, Radiant said, and killed her mother, were you surprised? Did you know she was going to do something that drastic?
I don't remember, Pattern said.
How can you not remember? Radiant pressed. He remained quiet. Radiant frowned, considering the lies she'd caught him in during the last few weeks. Why did you want to bond a human, Pattern? Radiant found herself asking. In the past, you've seemed so certain that Shallan would kill you, yet you bonded her anyway. Why?
This is a dangerous line of questioning, Radiant, Vale warned. Be careful.
Pattern said, humming to himself. Why? So many answers to a why. You want the truest one, but any such truth is also a lie, as it pretends to be the only answer.
He tipped his head to the right, looking toward the sky, though, so far as she knew, he didn't see forward, as he didn't have eyes. He seemed to sense all around him. She glanced in the same direction. Colors shimmered in the sky. It was a crystalline day.
You and the others, Pattern said, refer to Shadesmar as the world of the Spren, and the physical realm as your world, or the real world. That is not true. We are not two worlds, but one. And we are not two peoples, but one. Humans, Spren, two halves, neither complete. I wanted to be in the other realm, see that part of our world. And I knew danger was coming. All Spren could sense it. The Oath Pact was no longer working correctly. Void Spren were sneaking onto Roshar, using some kind of back door. Two halves cannot fight this enemy. We need to be whole.
And if Shallan killed you?
I was sure you would. But together, we cryptics thought we needed to try. And I volunteered. I thought, maybe even if I die, it will be the step other Spren need. You cannot reach the end of a proof without many steps in the middle, Shallan. I was to be the middle step.
He turned toward her.
I no longer believe you will kill me. Or perhaps I wish to no longer believe you will kill me. Ha ha.
Radiant wanted to believe. She wanted to know. This will lead to pain, Vale warned. Can I trust you, Pattern? Radiant asked.
Any answer will be a lie, he said. I cannot see the future like our friend Renarin, ha ha.
Pattern, have you lied to us? His pattern wilted.
Yes.
Radiant took a deep breath. And have you been spying on us? Have you been using the cube Marais gave us in secret?
I'm sorry, Radiant, he said softly. I couldn't think of another way.
Please answer the questions.
I have,
he said, his pattern growing even smaller. There, Radiant thought. Was that so hard? We should have asked him right away, Vale. It was only then that she noticed, deep inside, that Shallan was seething, twisting about herself, trembling, fuming, alternating between terror and anger. That didn't seem good. Pattern swirled small and tight.
I try to be worthy of trust. That is not a lie. But I have brought someone for Shallan to meet. I think it is important.
He stood with a smooth, inhuman motion, then gestured behind him with one long-fingered hand. Radiant frowned and glanced over her shoulder. Leaves from the trees farther up the plain lazily drifted down the central corridor. A faint shimmer dusted the air, and a small crystal tree started to grow in miniature on the bench beside her hand. Standing near a statue behind them was a dark figure wearing a stiff robe, like Pattern's, but dustier, and a head trapped in shadow, twisted and wrong. Damnation, Vale thought. Shallan emerged. She grabbed Radiant, shoved her away someplace dark and small, and slammed the door shut. Shallan, Vale thought. Then her voice crumpled. She should remain sectioned away. In the past, they hadn't talked to one another this way. They'd simply taken turns being in control, as they were needed. Shallan was in control. The other two became whispers. No, she said to Pattern. We are not doing this.
But,
he said. No, she said. I want nothing from you, Pattern. You are a traitor and a liar. You have betrayed my trust. He wilted, flopping onto the bench. Shallan saw movement from the corner of her eye and spun, her heart thundering in her ears. The small building she'd come here to watch, 16's home, had opened, and a furtive figure had emerged. Hunched over, face hidden in the cowl of a cloak, the figure hurried through the statue park. Excellent. It was time to fulfill Marais's mission. Shallan, Vale whispered. She ignored the voice and settled down on the bench, acting nonchalant as she opened her notebook. Vale's plan had included wandering through the statue park, idly flipping through her notebook, then bumping into 16, hopefully getting a good look at his face. Unfortunately, Shallan wasn't in position yet to do that. She'd been distracted by Pattern and his lies. She stood and meandered toward the statue garden, trying to appear non-threatening. She needed to determine for certain that 16 was her target,
Then what?
Kill him.
What are you doing?
Vale thought.
Such a distant, annoying voice. Couldn't she quiet it entirely?
You were the one who wanted to go forward with Moraes' plan, Shallan thought.
Well, I agree. So two of us have decided.
I wanted to gather information, Vale thought. I wanted to use it against him. Why are you suddenly so aggressive?
Because this was exactly who Shallan was, who she'd always been. She stalked toward the statue garden. Radiant was, of course, screaming and railing at her, but she was outvoted. Shallan had been watching and learning these last months, and she'd picked up some things from Vale. She knew to get into 16's blind spot, then stop and appear like she was sketching a statue. So when he turned to glance around, she seemed unremarkable. She knew to glide forward when he turned away. She knew to step carefully, putting the heel of her foot down first and rolling toward the toe. She knew to walk on the sides of her feet as much as possible, not letting the flats slap. She got right up behind 16 as he hunched over, fiddling with some notes. She grabbed him by the shoulder, then spun him around. His hood fell, revealing his face. He was Shin. There was no mistaking that pale, almost sickly skin and those childlike eyes. Rastaris was a short, Alethi man with wispy hair. This man was short, yes, but completely bald and was not Alethi. So unless Moraes was wrong, and Rastaris was a lightweaver, this was not her man. He shouted and said something to her in a language she didn't recognize. She released him, and he fled toward his home. Her heart thumping in her chest, she pulled her hand out of the satchel. She hadn't even realized she'd reached into that for a weapon. She didn't need it. This wasn't him. Pattern walked up, having recovered some of his characteristic perkiness. There was no sign of the other Spren he'd wanted her to meet.
Well, he said, that was exciting. But this is not him, is it?
No, Shallan said. It's not.
Shallan, I need to explain to you what I've been doing.
No, Shallan said, covering her pain. It is done. Let's move forward instead.
Pattern said. What has happened to you? Something has changed. Are you Vale?
No, Shallan said. I'm me, and I've finally made a difficult decision that was a long time coming. Come on, we need to report to Moraes. His intel was wrong. Rastaris is not in this fortress. 76. Harmony.
Such skills, like my honor itself, are now lost to time. Weathered away, crushed to dust and scattered to the ends of the Cosmere. I am a barren tree of a human being. I am the hollow that once was a mighty peak.
The sibling refused to speak to Navani. She lowered her hand and stared at the garnet vein in the wall. Such a wonderful secret. In plain sight, surrounding her all this time. So common, your eyes passed over it, and if you noticed it at all, you remarked only briefly, simply another pattern in the strata. The soul of Urethiru had been watching her all along. Perhaps if Navani had discovered it sooner, they could have achieved a different result. She replaced her hand on the vein. I'm sorry, she whispered. Please know that I'm sorry, truly. For the briefest moment, she thought the sibling would respond this time. Navani felt something, faint as the movement of a shadow deep within the ocean. No words came. With a sigh, Navani left the crystal vein and wound her way through the shelves of the small library, to reach her desk beside the door. Today, in addition to the guard, Raboniel's daughter, with the top knot and the vacant eyes, sat on the floor right inside. Navani settled onto her seat, trying to ignore the insane fused. Notes and half-finished experiments cluttered her desk. She didn't have the least bit of interest in continuing them. Why would she? Everything she'd attempted so far had been a sham. She wrote out her daily instructions to the scholars. She was having them perform tests on Voidspren fabrials, which Raboniel had delivered before everything went wrong. She gave this to a messenger, then sat there staring. Eventually, Raboniel herself made an appearance, wearing an Alethi Hava that fit her surprisingly well. Clearly a good dressmaker had tailored it to the fused's taller, more broad-shouldered frame. One might have thought her form would make her unfeminine, particularly with the unpronounced bust common to most singer femaleins. Instead, with the excellent cut and the confidence of her stride, Raboniel wore the dress as if it had always been designed to accentuate someone of height, power, and poise. She had made this fashion her own. Adolin would have approved. At least he was safe. Adolin, Renarin, Yasna, Dalinar, and little Gav. Her entire family safe from the invasion and the mess Navani had made. It was one small blessing she could thank the Almighty for sending her. Raboniel had brought a stool, a low one, so that when she sat on it, she was at eye level with Navani. The fused set a basket on the floor, then she pulled out a bottle of burgundy wine. A Shin vintage, sweeter than traditional Alethi wines, known as an Amostha, a Shin wine made from grapes.
"Your journals," Raboniel said, "indicate you are fond of this vintage."
"You read my journals?" Navani said.
"Of course," Raboniel said, setting out two glasses. "You would have wisely done the same in my position."
She uncorked the bottle and poured half a cup for Navani. She didn't drink. Raboniel didn't force her, instead inspecting the wine with an expert eye, then taking a sip.
"Ah, yes," she said. "That is a taste infused with memory. Grapes. Your ancestors never could get them to live outside Shinovar. Too cold, I believe. Or perhaps it was the lack of soil. I found that explanation odd, as grapevines seem similar to many of our native plants. I wasn't there when your kind came to our world. My grandmother, however, always mentioned the smoke. At first she thought you had strange skin patterns, but that was because so many human faces had been burned or marked by soot from the destruction of the world they left behind. She talked about the way your livestock moaned and cried from their burns, the result of humans surge binding without oaths, without checks. Of course, that was before any of us understood the surges. Before the Spren left us for you. Before the war started."
Navani felt the hair go up on the back of her neck as she listened. Storms. This creature. She had lived during the shadow days. The time before history. They had no primary accounts of those days. Yet one sat before her, drinking wine from Navani's secret stash, musing about the origins of humanity.
"So long ago," Raboniel said, with a soft, almost indistinguishable cadence to her words. "So very, very long ago. What has it been? 7,000 years? I don't think you can comprehend how tired I am of this war, Navani. How tired all of us are.
Your heralds, too.
Then let's end it, Navani said. Declare peace. Withdraw from the tower, and I will convince Dalinar to engage in talks.
Raboniel turned her wine cup around, as if trying to see the liquid within from different angles.
You think talks haven't been tried? We are born to fight one another, Navani. Opposites. At least, so I thought. I always assumed that if Stormlight and Voidlight could be forced to truly mix, then, poof, they'd annihilate one another. Much as we're doing to one another in this endless war.
Is that what this is all about? Navani asked. Why you want me to combine the lights so badly?
I need to know if you're right, Raboniel said. If you are, then so much of what I've planned will collapse. I wonder whether sometimes I can't see clearly anymore, whether I assume what I want to be true is true. You live long enough, Navani, and you forget to be careful. You forget to question.
Raboniel nodded toward Navani's desk.
No luck today?
No interest, Navani said. I think it is time for me to accept your initial offer and start carrying water.
Why waste yourself like that? Raboniel asked, her rhythm becoming intense. Navani, you can still defeat me. If it wasn't possible for humans to outthink the fused, you'd have fallen during the first few returns. The first few desolations, as you call them. Instead, you always pushed us back. You fought with stones, and you beat us. My kind pretends we know so much, but during many returns, we'd find ourselves struggling to catch up to your kind. That is our terrible secret. We hear the rhythms. We understand Roshar and the Spren. But the rhythms don't change. The Spren don't change. If you and I discover this secret together, you'll be able to use it better than I will. Watch and see. At the very least, prove me wrong. Show me that our two lights can meld and mix as you theorize.
Navani considered it, though storms she knew she shouldn't have. It was another trick, another catalyst added to the system to push the reaction forward. Yet Navani couldn't lie to herself. She did want to know. As always, questions teased her. Questions were disorder-awaiting organization. The more you understood, the more the world aligned, the more the chaos made sense, as all things should.
I've run into a problem, Navani said, finally taking a sip from her cup. I can make the two lights intersect. I can get them to pool around the same gemstone, swirling out like smoke caught in a current of air. But they won't mix.
Opposites, Raboniel said, leaning forward to look at the diagrams and notes Navani had made on each failed attempt.
No, merely inert substances, Navani said. The vast majority of elements, when combined, produce no reaction. I'd have long ago named these two things immiscible if I hadn't seen Towerlight.
It is what gave me the original idea, Raboniel said. I decided if there was a hybrid between Honor's Light and Cultivation's, there must be a reason no one had mixed Odium's light with either.
Questions are the soul of science, Navani said, sipping her wine. But assumptions must be proven, ancient one. From my research, I believe these two aren't opposites, but it isn't proven to me yet.
And to prove it?
We need an emulsifier, Navani said. Something that causes them to mix. Unfortunately, I can't fathom what such an emulsifier would be, though it might be related to sound. I only recently learned that Stormlight responds to tones. Yes, Raboniel said, taking a sphere off the desk. The sounds of Roshar.
Can you hear the light? Navani asked. Raboniel hummed, then thought to nod, her response. She held up a diamond, crystalline and pure, filled with stormlight from the high storm the day before.
You have to concentrate and know what you're seeking to hear it from a sphere.
A pure tone, extremely soft. Navani hit the proper tuning fork, letting the tone ring in the room. Raboniel nodded.
Yes, that is it. Exactly the same. Only...
Navani sat up.
Only? The sphere's tone has a rhythm to it,
Raboniel explained, eyes closed as she held the sphere.
Each light has a rhythm. Honors is stately. Cultivations is stark and staccato, but builds.
And Odium's?
Chaos, she said, but with a certain strange logic to it. The longer you listen, the more sense it makes.
Navani sat back, sipping her wine, wishing she had access to Rushu and the other scholars. Raboniel had forbidden her from drawing on their expertise in this matter, giving the problem to Navani alone. Navani, who wasn't a scholar. What would Yasna do in this situation? Well, other than find a way to kill Raboniel. Navani felt the answers were right in front of her. So often that was the case with science. The ancient humans had fought with stone weapons, but the secrets to metallurgy had been within their grasp.
Does Tower Light have a tone? Navani asked.
Two tones, Raboniel said, opening her eyes and setting down the stormlight sphere. But they aren't simply the tones of cultivation and of honor. They are different, changed, so that they are in harmony with one another.
Curious, Navani said. And is there a rhythm to it?
Yes, Raboniel said. Both tones adopt it, harmonizing as they play the same rhythm. A symphony combining honor's control and cultivation's ever-building majesty.
Their tower-light spheres had all run out by now, and Raboniel had no way to restore them, so there was nothing for them to check. Plants grow by stormlight, Navani said, if you beat the proper rhythm in their presence.
An old agricultural trick, Raboniel said. It works better with lifelight. If you can find some.
Why, though? Navani asked. Why does light respond to tones? Why is there a rhythm that makes plants grow? Navani dug in her materials and began setting up an experiment.
I have asked myself this question many times, Raboniel said. But it seems like asking why gravity pulls. Must we not accept some fundamentals of science as baselines? That some things in this world simply work?
No, we don't have to, Navani said. Even gravity has a mechanism driving it. There are proofs to show why the most basic addition problems work. Everything has an explanation.
I have heard, Raboniel said, that the lights respond to sound, because it is reminiscent of the voice of the shards, commanding them to obey.
Navani hit the tuning forks, touched them to their respective gemstones, then put them in place. A thin stream of stormlight ran from one gemstone, a thin stream of void light from the other. They met together at the center, swirling around an empty gemstone. Neither light entered it.
Void light and stormlight, Navani said. The voices of gods.
Or perhaps something older than that. The reason the beings called gods spoke the way they did.
Raboniel came in close, shoulder to shoulder with Navani as they observed the streams of light.
You said that stormlight and lifelight make a rhythm together when they mix, she said. So, if you could imagine a rhythm that mixed stormlight and void light, what would it be like?
Those two, Raboniel said. It wouldn't work, Navani. They're opposites. One orderly, organized, the other...
Her words drifted off, and her eyes narrowed.
The other, chaotic, Raboniel whispered, but with a logic to it, an understandable logic. Could we perhaps contrast it? Chaos always seems more powerful when displayed against an organized background.
Finally, she pursed her lips.
No, I cannot imagine it.
Navani tapped the rim of her cup, inspecting the failed experiment.
If you could hear the rhythms, Raboniel said, you'd understand. But that is beyond humans.
Sing one for me, Navani said. Honors tone and rhythm. Raboniel complied, singing a pure, vibrant note, the tone of stormlight, the same as made by the tuning fork. Then she made the tone waver, vibrate, pulse in a stately rhythm. Navani hummed along, matching the tone, trying to affix it into her mind. Raboniel was obviously overemphasizing the rhythm, making it easier for her to recognize. Change now, Navani said, to Odium's rhythm. Raboniel did so, singing a discordant tone with a violent, chaotic rhythm. Navani tried to match it with Honor's tone. She had vocal training, like any light-eyed woman of her dawn. However, it hadn't been an area of express study for her. Though she tried to hold the tone against Raboniel's forceful rhythm, she quickly lost the note. Raboniel cut off, then softly hummed a different rhythm.
That was a fine attempt, Raboniel said. Better than I've heard from other humans. But we must admit you simply aren't built for this kind of work.
Navani took a drink, then swirled the wine in her cup.
Why did you want me to sing those rhythms? Raboniel asked. What were you hoping to accomplish?
I thought that perhaps if we melded the two songs, we could find the proper harmony that would come from a combination of stormlight and voidlight.
It won't be easy, Raboniel said. The tones would need to change to find a harmony. I've tried this many times, Navani, and always failed. The songs of Honor and Odium do not mesh.
Have you tried it with a human before? Navani asked.
Of course not. Humans, as we just proved, can't hold to a tone or rhythm.
We proved nothing, Navani said. We had a single failed experiment. She set her cup on the table, then crossed the room and dug through her things. She emerged with one of her arm sheaths, in which she'd embedded a clock and other devices. Like other stormlight fabrials in the tower, it didn't work any longer, but it was rigged to hold a long sequence of gemstones. Navani ripped off the interior leather of the sheath, then settled at the table and fiddled with the screws and set new gemstones, full of stormlight, into it.
What is this? Raboniel said.
You can hear the songs and rhythms of Roshar, Navani said. Perhaps it's merely because you have better hearing. Raboniel hummed a skeptical rhythm, but Navani continued setting the gemstones.
We can hear them because we are the children of Roshar, Raboniel said. You are not.
I've lived here all my life, Navani said. I'm as much a child of this planet as you are.
Your ancestors were from another realm.
I'm not speaking of my ancestors, Navani said, strapping the sheath on so the flats of the gemstones touched her arm. I'm speaking of myself. She reset her experiment on the table, sending new lines of stormlight and voidlight out of gemstones, making them swirl at the center around an empty one. Sing Honor's tone and rhythm again, Ancient One, Navani asked.
Raboniel sat back on her stool, but complied. Navani closed her eyes, tightening her arm sheath. It had been built as a fabrile, but she wasn't interested in that function. All she wanted was something that would hold large gemstones and press them against her skin. She could feel them now, cool but warming to her touch. Infused gemstones always had a tempest inside. Was there a sound to them too? A vibration? Could she hear it in there? The tone? The rhythm? With Raboniel singing, she thought she could. She matched that tone and felt something on her arm. The gemstones reacting, or rather the stormlight inside reacting. There was a beat to it, one that Raboniel's rhythm only hinted at. Navani could sing the tone and feel the gemstones respond. It was like having a stronger singer beside her. She could adapt her voice to match. The stormlight itself guided her, providing a control with a beat and rhythm. Navani added that rhythm to her tone, tapping her foot, concentrating. She imagined a phantom song to give it structure. "Yes," Raboniel said, cutting off. "Yes, that's it." "Odium's rhythm now," Navani said, to honor's tone and beat. Raboniel did so, and it struck Navani like a wave, making her tone falter. She almost lost it, but the gemstones were her guide. Navani sang louder, trying to hold that tone. In turn, Raboniel sang more forcefully. "No," Navani thought, taking a breath, then continuing to sing. "No, we can't fight." She took Raboniel's hand, singing the tone, but softer. Raboniel quieted as well. Holding the fused's hand, Navani felt as if she were reaching for something. Her tone changed slightly. Raboniel responded, their two tones moving toward one another, step by step, until harmony. The rhythms snapped into alignment. A burst of chaotic notes from Raboniel, bounded by a regular, orderly pulse from Navani. Heartbeats, drum beats, signals, together. Navani reached over and placed their clasped hands on the empty gemstone at the center of the experiment, holding them there as they sang for an extended moment in concert, in tandem, a pure harmony where neither took control. The two of them looked at each other, then fell silent. Carefully, they removed their hands to reveal a diamond glowing a vibrant black-blue, an impossible color. Raboniel trembled as she picked the gemstone out of its place, then held it up, humming a reverential rhythm. "They did not annihilate one another, as I assumed. Indeed, as part of me hoped." "You were right, Navani. Remarkably, I have been proven wrong." She turned the gemstone in her fingers. "I can name this rhythm. The rhythm of war. Odium and honor mixed together. I had not known it before today, but I recognize its name. I know this as surely as I know my own. Each rhythm carries with it an understanding of its meaning." The sphere they had created was different from Zeth's, blue instead of violet, and lacking the strange distortion. Navani couldn't be certain, but it seemed to her that was what Raboniel had been seeking. "Ancient One," Navani said. "Something confuses me. Why would you have preferred that these two annihilate one another?" Navani had an inkling why, but she wanted to see what she could prompt the fused to reveal. Raboniel sat for a long time, humming softly to herself as she inspected the gemstone. She seemed fascinated by the motion within. The stormlight and the voidlight mixed to form something that surged in brilliant, raging storms, then fell still, peaceful and quiet, between. "Do you know," the fused finally asked, "how Honor was killed?"
"I am not certain I accept that he was."
"Oh, he was. At least the being you call the Almighty, the being who controlled the shard of power that was Honor, is dead. Long dead. Do you know how?"
"No,
neither do I," Raboniel said. "But I wonder."
Navani sat back in her seat. "Surely, if it is true, and my husband says it is so, so I accept the possibility, then the mechanisms of the deaths of gods are far beyond the understanding of humans and fused alike."
"And did you not tell me earlier that everything has a mechanism? The gods give us powers. What are those powers? Gravitation, division, transformation, the fundamental surges that govern all things. You said that nothing simply is. I accept that, and your wisdom. But by that same logic, the gods, the shards, must work not by mystery, but by knowledge."
She turned the gemstone in her fingers, then met Navani's eyes.
"Honor was killed using some process we do not yet understand. I assume, from things I have been told, that some opposite was used to tear his power apart. I thought if I could discover this opposite light, then we would have power over the gods themselves. Would that not be the power to end a war?"
"Storms. That was what he'd wanted. That was what Gavilar had been doing. Gemstones, void light, a strange sphere that exploded when affixed to a fabril, when mixed with another light. Gavilar Kolin, king, husband, occasional monster, had been searching for a way to kill a god. Suddenly, the extent of his arrogance and his magnificent planning snapped together for Navani. She knew something Raboniel did not. There was an opposite to void light. It wasn't stormlight, nor was it this new mixed light they'd created. But Navani had seen it, held it. Her husband had given it to Zeth, who had given it to her. "By the holiest name of the Almighty," she thought, "it makes sense." But like all great revelations, it led to a multitude of new questions. Why? How? Raboniel stood up, completely oblivious to Navani's epiphany. The fused tucked away the gemstone, and Navani forced herself to focus on this moment, this discovery.
"I thought for certain it was something about the nature of Odium's power, contrasting Honor's power, that led to the destruction," Raboniel said. "I was wrong, and you have proven exceedingly helpful in leading me to this proof. Now I must abandon this line of reasoning and focus on my actual duty, the securing of the tower."
"And your promise that you would leave if I helped you find this light?"
"I'm sorry," Raboniel said. "Next time, try not to be so trusting."
"In the end," Navani whispered, "you are his, and I am Honor's."
"Unfortunately," Raboniel said, "you may remain here and continue whatever other research you wish. You have earned that, and my gratitude. If you would like to seek a simple job in the tower instead, I will arrange it. Consider your options, then tell me your wishes."
Raboniel hesitated.
"It is rare for a fused to be in the debt of a human."
With that, she left. Navani, in turn, downed the rest of the cup of wine, her head abuzz with implications. 77. The proper legality. 7.5 years ago, Venley ducked out of the way of a patrol of human guards
As she hid in the doorway, she attuned peace in an attempt to calm her emotions. She'd come with her people to sign the treaty, but that, and the feast to mark the occasion, was still hours away. While her people prepared, Venli crept through forbidden hallways in their palace. The pair of guards, chatting in the Alethi tongue, continued on their patrol. She breathed quietly, trying hard not to let the majesty of this human building overwhelm her. Ulim assured her that her people had built equally grand structures once, and they would again. They would build such amazing creations. This palace of Kolinar would look like a hut by comparison. Would that she could skip this middle part, where she was required to be in such danger. Planning with Ulim, that she liked. Being famous for revealing warform, that she loved. This creeping about, though, she'd expressly disobeyed human rules, slipping into forbidden sections of the palace. If she were caught, she closed her eyes and listened to the rhythm of peace. Only a little longer, she thought. Just until Ulim's companions reach us, then this will all be over. However, she found herself questioning more now that Ulim had left her gem heart. Ulim spoke of a hidden storm and a coming war, with figures of legend returning to fight. That talk spun in her head, and things that seemed so rational a day ago now confused her. Was this really the best way to convince her people to explore forms of power? Wasn't she toying with war and destruction? Why was Ulim so eager? As soon as they'd reached the palace, he'd insisted that she help him gather a bag of gemstones left by his agent here. More Spren, like him, ready to be delivered to Venli's scholars. That hadn't been part of the original plan. She'd merely wanted to show her people how dangerous the humans were. But what was she to do? She'd started this boulder rolling down the cliff. If she tried to stop it now, she'd be crushed. So she continued doing as he said. Even if without him in her gem heart, she felt old and dull. Without him, she couldn't hear the new rhythms. She craved them. The world made more sense when she listened to those.
There you are, Ulim said, zipping down the hallway.
He moved like lightning, crawling along the top of the stone, and he could vanish, making only certain people able to see him.
Why are you cringing like a child? Come on, we must be moving.
She glanced around the corner. The guards had long since moved on.
I shouldn't have to do this, Venli hissed at him. I shouldn't have to expose myself.
Someone needs to carry the gemstones, Ulim said. So unless you want me to find someone else to be the greatest among your people, do what I say.
Fine.
She crept after him, though lately she'd found Ulim's tone increasingly annoying. She disliked his crass, dismissive attitude. He'd better not abandon her again. He had claimed he needed to scout the way, but she was half convinced he wanted her to be discovered. He led her up a stairwell. The rhythm of fortune blessed her, and she emerged onto the top floor without meeting any humans, though she did have to hide in the stairwell as more guards passed.
Why must we come all the way up here? She hissed after they passed. Couldn't your friend have brought the gemstones into the basement, where all the other listeners are?
I lost contact with her, Ulim admitted.
You what? Venli said.
He whirled on the floor. Then the lightning rose up to form his little human-like figure.
I haven't heard from Axen Dweth in a few days. I'm certain it's all right. We have a meeting point where she leaves things for me. The gemstones will be there.
Venli hummed to betrayal. How could he leave out such an important detail? She was sneaking through the human palace, jeopardizing the treaty, based on flawed information? Before she could demand more answers, however,
Ulim turned back into a patch of energy on the floor and shot forward. She had no choice but to scramble after him across the hallway, feeling terribly exposed. They should have brought Demid. She liked how he listened to what she said, and he always had a ready compliment. He'd enjoy sneaking about, and she'd feel braver with him along. She wove through the hallways, certain she'd be discovered at any moment. Yet by some miracle, Ulim got her through to a small room with chamber pots scattered across the floor. She pulled out a gemstone and noted a hole in the floor on one side of the room. It looked like they'd dumped waste in here, pouring it into some foul cesspit several stories below. This was her goal? A privy? She gagged and was forced to start breathing through her mouth. Here, Ulim said, crackling on the side of one of the chamber pots. So help me, Venli said to skepticism. If I find human waste inside... She removed the lid. Fortunately, the interior was clean and empty, save for a folded piece of paper. Ulim pulsed to exultation. He'd been worried, it seemed. Venli unfolded the paper and knew the Alethi script well enough to figure out it was a list of cleaning instructions.
It's ciphered, Ulim said. Do you think we'd be so stupid as to leave notes in the open where anyone could read them? Let me interpret.
He formed into the shape of a human, standing on a table full of pots. She hated that he took a human form, rather than that of a listener. He leaned forward, his eyes narrow.
Bother, he said.
What?
Let me think, femalean, he snapped.
What does it say?
Axin Dweth says she's been discovered, he said. She's a very specific and rare kind of specialist. The details need not concern you. But there is apparently another of her kind in the palace, an agent for someone else. They found her and turned the human king against her. She's decided to pull out.
Pull out? Venli said. I don't understand the phrasing.
She's leaving, or left, perhaps days ago.
Left the palace?
The planet, you idiot!
Ulim blurred, carapace-like barbs breaking his skin and jabbing out, then retracting. It seemed to happen to the beat of one of the new rhythms, perhaps fury. Ulim told her so little. Venli knew there was a way to travel from this world to the place the humans called Damnation, the land of the Void Spren. Many thousands of Spren waited there to help her people, but they couldn't get free without some surge or power, something to pull them across the void between worlds. So what did this mean? Had his agent returned to the world Ulim had come from? Or had she gone someplace else? Was she gone for good? How were they going to transfer Spren across to this land to build power for the storm? More importantly, did Venli want that to happen? He'd promised her forms of power, but she'd assumed that she'd bring this to the Five after frightening them with how powerful the humans were. Everything was moving so quickly, slipping out of her control. She almost demanded answers, but the way those spikes broke Ulim's skin, the way he pulsed, made her remain quiet. He was a force of nature come alive, and the particular force he exhibited now was destructive. Eventually his pulsing subsided. The spikes settled beneath his skin. He remained standing on the table, staring at the sheet of paper with the offending words. What do we do? Venli finally asked.
I don't know. There is nothing here for us. I have to leave. See if I can find answers elsewhere.
Leave? Venli said. What about your promises? What about our plans?
We have no plans, Ulim said, spinning on her. You said coming here would intimidate your people. Is that happening? Because from what I've seen, they seem to be enjoying themselves, planning to feast and laugh, Maybe get into storming bed with the humans.
Venli attuned determination, and then it faded to reconciliation. She had to admit it. Her people weren't intimidated, not like she was. Even Eshonai had grown more relaxed, not more worried, as they'd interacted with the humans. These days, Venli's sister didn't even wear war form. Venli wanted to blame her alone, but the problems with the listeners were far bigger than Eshonai. No one else seemed to see what Venli did. They should have been terrified by all the parshmen, the enslaved singers, in the palace. Instead, Venli's people seemed curious. No one saw the threat, Venli did. She didn't understand or believe some of the things Ulim said. But in coming here, Venli realized for herself that the humans could not be trusted. If she didn't do anything, it would be her people, her mother, enslaved to the humans. Ulim formed into crackling lightning and zipped down the table leg and along the floor. She took a step after him, attuning the terrors, but he was gone, out under the door. By the time she looked into the hall, he'd vanished. She closed the door and found herself